to havens with darkness, darkness. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, July the 18th. And before I say another word, I have to explain my absence. I've had a, let's just put it this way. My dentist got himself confused with an oil driller. And I swear he went to the core of the earth in taking care of a tooth problem that I had, having to replace a cap and so forth, and put me out of commission for a while. But I'm back. I'm good. I'm hanging in. And today I'm codeine free. So the pain is down, way, way down. So I'm coming back to normal now. Well, we will pick up the conversation from where we left off, and that had to do with this case and some of the structural issues that it points up. And one of the things, of course, we see a pattern, a very familiar pattern evolving, and that is, you know, people already trying to situate themselves and to try to figure out how they can benefit from this thing. This is a kind of event, believe it or not, as sad as it is, as awful as it is, that people actually try to profit from. They try to get a number of things that they normally wouldn't get, prizes for, quote, journalism, unquote. They get books like the juror attempted to do. And, of course, public pressure swatted that ambition away. But we have a number of initiatives occurring, and the main one is seeking from the Justice Department some kind of legal action against Zimmerman, as a feeling that the State Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, somehow will pull a rabbit out of the hat. And I did talk with you the last time about this experience I had in one of the most telling cases that we saw in recent memory, and that was the shooting death of Amadou Diallo by four police officers. And the State Department was supposed to come in and do something then, and it did not. And it was Eric Holder to whom this plea was personally made, and who had said he was going to look into it. And if ever there was a case that merited federal involvement, I would say that was a case. But to tell you the truth, in these past couple of days, I've been so angry. And I got to the point where I just didn't want to watch television, didn't want to even hear it, because it is overbearing, overwhelming. The notion that in order for society to move forward, people have to die. You know, people talk, well, what could we learn from this experience? Well, you know, this is yet another example of a black person having to die so that somebody may learn something that they should have known a long time ago. I am just so fed up of the phrase, our thoughts and prayers are with you, because they're not thinking, and they're certainly not prayerful people. So you know that's an empty phrase. Or, you know, you hear these forlorn parents talking about, well, I pray that my child's death is not in vain, these kinds of things. We should be livid every time we hear that kind of phrase, because it means somebody's child has died, has been killed in a very brutal way. And when does it end? When does it stop? What would it take to stop it? I looked at the irony of the media covering this case. all of the major channels and you know, CNN and HLN and whatnot. And you know what was odd? There wasn't one single black person in a position of authority on this case. Not one. On any of the channels. And yet they're talking about, well, you know, racial equality and so forth. The liberals are talking about racial equality. And the ranks of the editorial rooms remain as white as they were in the 1960s, when the Kerner Commission wrote a report, a stinging report, that said that the racial bifurcation of America, in part, in large measure, as a matter of fact, was the outgrowth of the apartheid system in the newsrooms. Oh, it's to sit and hear Piers Morgan, who basically is learning the ropes of America as we speak, become suddenly very, very adept at African American history. So we are even educating the folks who are the experts on this and the reporting, and you know, it just gets to be so much. It gets to be so much. I see the Reverend Al Sharpton has organized a 100-city protest on Saturday in service of this request to the U.S. Department of Justice to become involved. But, you know, I really don't know that there should be that high an expectation. I don't know that they would find or would have the nerve to go after anything like that. But if ever there was to be a meaningful request of the Department of Justice, it certainly should be a criminal investigation of the prosecutor's office. I have not changed my mind. I have not moved one centimeter off my mark. And you see, more and more people are beginning to express these things loudly. This was a horrific case from a prosecutorial point of view. And as I said, the case's outcome was decided that very night in the station house. And it had to have involved somebody from the prosecutor's office. It had to have involved somebody on the police department in Sanford. And it possibly might even have involved a judge. Because those would be the elements that would be necessary to take the handcuffs off of a suspect and release him on his own recognizance, only to be lost for 44 plus days. So let's get back to our conversation at 888-874-4888. If you call regularly, it would be good if you can get somebody a chance to call in too. 888-874-4888. We'll be talking about this for some time because you see, there's the pattern. The pattern is a community goes through a trauma like this, a huge, huge upswing in emotion. And then the leaders come in, leaders of all types, they come in for all kinds of reasons. And before you know it, the justified rage is transmuted into dignified reaction. Dignified meaning you're quiet and you go away. That's what dignified means. You're very dignified. And people tend to say that when the victims and the families of victims literally suck it up in service of a larger objective. I suppose in this case it would be the civil suit, which I know hangs before everybody. But it is sad. It is a sad thing to see this cycle go through time and time and time again. I'm personally tired of it. I really am. I'm tired of having to go to funerals or writing stories or talking about these kinds of things that are going on in our community. People's children are dying. They're worthy too. They are valuable too. They have hearts and minds and emotions too. But at some point, there is going to be a radical and dramatic departure from the norm, and this country will not be ready for it. And it will make the 60s look like a fairy tale. The level of anger is just going to pour out in a moment we least suspect. Hello, Harvey from Berkeley. You're on the air.
Hi, Eutrice. Well, I'd like to hope you're feeling better.
I am. Thank you.
Good. And I hope you mend well.
Thank you.
I'd like to speak about death and the way Americans perceive death. And first of all, when somebody dies, like on the street or something, the first thing we do is cover the body up, and then the morgue truck arrives and they put the body in a body bag. And the last thing they want us to do is look and see death. The last thing, it's like it's so covered up and so protected in a sense. And at the same time, they dish up as much death as you want in the media, in the movies, horror movies, comic book heroes. It's just death, death, death. Now, when they had Vietnam, when they were fighting the war in Vietnam, the armed forces found that when the images went out over television, it really traumatized the people, and they marched en masse. So they learned that in the Iraq War, never show bodies of the dead. And I think that, in a sense, we're in a state of fantasy, and especially the young people. I don't know if you've seen playing video games, but they're very realistic. It basically shows a pair of hands with a gun, and you're just shooting people coming out of doorways. But there's no real sense of death. I think that we, in a sense, have been manipulated, and that if children and people were allowed to see real death when it occurs, instead of our makeup-style funeral situation, that they would see what death really is, not just the Hollywood version of it. I think we've been, in a sense, conditioned to see death as a Hollywood event, and not really what it really is, not the actual physical body and, so on and so forth. And I find a lot of people come back from war, they're traumatized, a lot of the vets, because they did participate in real death, either seeing it or taking part in it, and they're traumatized. So it's there has to be a new kind of way to make people appreciate real death as opposed to Hollywood death, and then I think we can get a grasp on it. But right now, death is completely fantasy-ridden, and of course the gun manufacturers.
Well, not in certain communities, I can assure you of that, Harvey. There are communities that know death quite intimately.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is that in these communities, death is so frequently occurring that they literally are anesthetized by it now because it is so frequent. Right today, you hear the news about this, how people are just killing each other and, just disposing of the bodies in a kind of mind-numbing way. So I think it has to do with certain communities. The richer you are, the more distant you are from the nearness of death.
That's true.
Thank you so much, Harvey, for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hope you recover better.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Anyway, I've been following this. I didn't follow it initially, but I've recently been following it because there's so much coverage, and it seems like that Zimmerman had already had his weapon out to begin with, because apparently he shot right away. There was no safety on the gun. The bullet was in the chamber. He just shot right away, according to his own accounts. So he must have been. I don't think you don't put a weapon that has a safety off in your pocket. Basically, you basically have it in your hand. So basically, when he was stalking Trayvon, he probably had his weapon out.
Probably so. But, you know, again, I just want us to go back to that station house. I would just love to know what happened there that night and who made the decisions, because that is where this whole case started.
Yeah,
that
well,
very night.
Well, we lost a lot of evidence that night because, you know, usually when he disappears for so many days, he has time to cover up a lot of evidence that, you know, was
precisely.
Never...
Including possibly, you know, some of the so-called injuries, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. When did the injury photos show up? Is it the same night or later on?
Who knows? We don't know when these photos showed up, but we do know. I mean, if you're missing for 44 days and you have the time, you know, you used to be in a gym and you certainly know people who could, as they say, work you over. You may volunteer if you're in a really bad way, defense-wise, because he had the advice of people that he knew. He was, you know, he had ridden around in this squad cars with these officers, so they knew a thing or two of, you know, how to coach him into what it is, the predicament he was in, and what he could do to get out. I know. But that's the truth.
Yeah, but apparently there's another side to the story also, because it's coming out that Trayvon's girlfriend was goading him into, because Trayvon told his girlfriend, you know, what was going on, and apparently she was saying that he may be after him, you know, after Trayvon, for him to be taking aggressive posture. So that may also have been part of this whole mix where, you know, Trayvon attacked him because he thought he was being stalked, you know. So that's another factor going in there. So I don't know how that fits into all of this. But,
well, it was fascinating to me watching what I consider to be an extremely unimpressive prosecutorial team, and they made the defense look like sheer geniuses. But in all of the lawyers combined were not at all impressive.
No, actually,
very unimpressive. So, you know, they gave all this, you know, weight to the fact that, oh, they need witnesses. So, I mean, let's suppose that the murder occurred, of course, and nobody at all neither heard nor saw anything. So it's an unsolvable crime. Nobody knows how to investigate a crime anymore. It's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay, for calling. 888-874-4888 is the number. We try to catch up with your thoughts as we see what is developing. And what is developing is very disturbing. It's quite disturbing. And I would say the one extraordinary development that I have noted, and that is the younger people are very serious and committed to this quest for justice. And there are so many white kids involved. They really do understand what's going on. And they understand the hypocrisy of the society they're in. And the oddest thing, and this is just a theory of mine, the very thing that people have been condemning for years now, hip-hop music, is what brought them together and what brought them to a sensibility about the community and about people their age. So it was not a stretch for them to identify with the brutal murder of Trayvon Martin, because there was a certain kind of camaraderie that they had experienced, even, you know, in terms of music, bringing them closer and closer to a common understanding of what it is we ought to appreciate at each other, what is of value and what is not, what is hypocrisy, what is not. And that is the very important force that has brought that change around. But they're also, you know, people of conscience. And anybody observing the developments of this case in the last several months, in fact, in the last year, can't help but be disturbed by the outcome. And I don't know that I particularly take the view that, well, the jurors followed their instructions. No, I don't think the jurors followed their instructions. I think the jurors followed their social coding. Sean from Yonkers, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, how you doing, Yatrice?
Fine, thank you.
You know, I watched the interview with Juror B37 on Anderson Cooper, and I literally wanted to throw up. And reason being is because it just seemed like she just automatically befriended and bought everything the defense said with regard to George Zimmerman. And she even called him George numerous times. Mm-hmm. And then refers to Trayvon as, you know, that boy or that boy of color. And it's funny, in looking at that, I said, here we go once again, where, you know, over and over, it's shown that white people, you know, don't really emphasize or care about what happens unless it is to somebody white. And it was so telling in that interview how, you know, she so emphasized with George and even said that she wouldn't mind him being the neighborhood watchman, you know, again. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like it was like this us against them mentality, like we live here and they live there and they're not like us. And it's like they're not human like us. And again, it just goes to show that many white folks in this country could care less about what happens to anybody else unless they're white.
So how do you break that pattern?
That's a good question, because this country was born out of racism. And it's very, I think it's systematic to the point where it's going to be extremely difficult to break that pattern and correct that pattern in the minds of people. You know, you can't change what people think. It's very difficult to change what people have grown up thinking all their lives. You know, even if you present them with the truth, you know, they can, in most cases, they're still in denial. And I think I think that's going to be a very difficult pattern to break. Doesn't mean we shouldn't fight it and attempt to break it, but, you know, just looking at the way this country has operated since its birth, at times I just don't see where it's going to get any better. You would think, it being now 2013, that situations of this kind or this kind of thinking would have left us, but what this juror just showed was basically it's almost like it's still 1913 again.
Let me ask you about the flip side of the coin. People say, you know, it's not just whites who are affected this way. Blacks also are affected. Latinos are affected. Every mm-hmm. ethnic group has its own perception. Mm-hmm. And we are all enculturated in one way or the other with respect to how we see ourselves in our society. What do you say about that?
Now, to your point, yes, the flip side of that is that, yes, people do have their own biases, okay? You know, racism can work in both directions, but I think we tend to pin it on white people more because with them, racism controls people's lives. In other words, the institution controls people's lives. In the criminal justice system, it controls people's lives. We as black people or minorities or people of color in this country, we don't have that power to quote-unquote control people's lives. But that doesn't mean we don't have our own internal prejudices and biases against other people that don't look like us. So it goes all the way around. But again, with them, there's a system built around it. We don't have a system built around our own biases. They do.
That's interesting. Very interesting. I'm sure someone would react to that, Sean. But that was a very interesting presentation that you gave us there, something to ponder.
Of course.
Thank you so much.
You know, and, you know, again, I would love to see that cycle broken from all human beings. But unfortunately, I just don't see that cycle or that pattern of thinking being easily broken, particularly if you've already grown up being taught bias and prejudice.
Now, I happen to think along the lines that you're talking, because you know what? I personally resent the idea of always having to educate people to how I should be treated.
Right.
I resent it.
Right.
I come to a situation with the assumption that, hey, you know, you're another person. I'm a person. Let's get along as one person to another.
Well,
that's my demeanor.
That is exactly my demeanor, the same thing. I don't judge people on what they bring looks-wise to the table, because I've met guys on the street, baseball cap turned sideways, blah, 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 and, you know, at first glance, you might think they're a thug, and then when you talk to these guys, the guy might be a computer engineer. But you'd never know that because you automatically presume, because he's dressed a certain way and looks a certain way, that he can't be a certain way. And, you know, this goes across the realm with all people. You know, so I've learned, and, you know, my mother has taught me this since I was a child, because my mother being West Indian, you know, she was always very liberal in terms of how you're supposed to treat other people. And I was always a kid growing up that I didn't care what color you were as a friend, just as long as we could friends and we could see eye to eye on things and we get along. That's how I looked at it. But in growing up as a black man in America, you know, I've had to form, I wouldn't call it so much an internal bias or hate toward other people, but I'm aware of the other biases, so to speak.
You have
so
to be.
When it presents
I learned
itself,
to do
I'm
that
God
when I came here myself.
Right.
Yeah, you have to learn the social order in your environment.
Exactly.
In Trinidad, where I was born and raised, I didn't have these things to think about. But
you know,
here, it's just like,
well,
what?
You know, it's funny. My mother says the same thing. My mother's from Guyana, and she said, you know, growing up in Guyana, you know, she said, they didn't separate us going to school from the East Indians or the Chinese or whoever. We all went to school together. You all ate at the same restaurants together. You know, you all basically supported each other's businesses because those businesses were in the community. There was no such thing as, well, because so-and-so is Indian, I can't support him, and so-and-so is black, I can't support him. It didn't really work like that. And she said until she came to the United States, that's when she really learned what prejudice, racism really, really was.
Yeah, and you have to learn it if you're going to survive.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Sean, for calling. Thank you very much. Thank you. Eric, you're on the air.
Hey, Trees, how are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you.
It's
thank
a
you
great
so much.
Program, and you know, I hope you get better quickly.
I'm getting better. I'm already better. Just hearing
great.
Everybody's voices.
great. Yeah, I wanted to make a comment about the Trayvon Martin situation.
Yes.
And Zimmerman. I mean, you know my stance in terms of the whole idea of power and racism in this country, and this is just another example of it. And I think that black people need to start taking, I mean, we've been taking these actions, but I think we have to regain a consciousness of actually working at, you know, on all levels, on whatever levels you're at. Don't buy into their system. Don't buy into their processes. You know, this whole idea of electing people that don't represent you, this whole idea of supporting, you know, these businesses that could, you know, care less about you, this whole idea of buying into the fact that people only are for you when they need something from you, you know, I think people need to stop buying into this system, stop buying their products. If we withdraw our money from this system, it will do much more to change the system than to continue to participate. The protests, yes, they're going to do, you know, they're gonna be maybe inspirational. They're going to be basically disregarded by the majority of the people who are white in this country. They're going to be disregarded. They're going to be denigrated because it's really not affecting people in any real way.
Well, you know, the last time, that's 2 days ago, Patricia made that very point, that there ought to be a very serious economic campaign, because this, after all, is a capitalist society, that people mm-hmm. appreciate the impact of withdrawal of funds from any particular sector. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I am for some plan that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I am for everybody doing whatever it is they think they can do. I mean, but to do it from start to finish. Don't just give up. You know, just do it from start to finish and find people who can understand what the issue is here. Mm-hmm. This is a travesty. And I mean, personally, I'm just kind of tired of these cases. I'm tired of it.
Absolutely.
We lost hundreds and thousands of lives this way. People would never believe it, that in New York City alone, in the last decade, I mean, thousands of people have been shot dead by police.
But you treat, you know,
and by other situations that warranted very close inspection, you know?
Absolutely.
They just
that's kind of the whole idea of the money and this whole equation. It's crucial. And you look at people, where we put our money. We put our money, for example, my kids, I have to pay for their school, but I refuse to put them in a public school. So I work 7 days almost every week, but I have to put them in a better school. You know, I don't buy them the video games. I don't buy them the sneakers that everybody, because it's a waste of money. So we're wasting money on, for example, you look at Jay-Z, he gave us a stadium. How about look at his neighborhood? You know, look at what's happening in the Zabra, Marcy Project. Look at what's happening. The gentrification, the no resources for schools, the closing down of the schools in that neighborhood. No libraries, no programs. The kids are sitting outside on their stoops. And then when they're victimized, we have a lot to say. We have to realize that we have to do more for our kids than buying them things. So we have to start actually being conscious about what we're doing with our money. I know that because of labor, we're not able to be around as much as we might like to be. But if we start being wise with the money, this is the only thing that people in this country, the capitalists respond to, money and how to exploit it. We have to become more aware, just like Malcolm X said. We have to circulate the money amongst us. We have to make sure that we have that power so that we're not bought out every time there's an issue. We're not bought out every time there's a candidate. We're not bought out every time there's some kind of event that we need to protest. If you look at the access that we have because of the lack of money, and the access that everybody else has, all these white people on TV that are able to talk about their feelings and that are able to continue the whole prejudice and racism. And there's really very little we could do but protest, and they just look at that and, oh, look at these people marching around. And we have to change it. Hello?
All right. I'm listening very intently, very intently, Eric. Thank you so much.
I'm talking about it. Thank you. Thank you for this platform.
Thank you very much for calling and contributing. Lloyd from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrecht.
Good afternoon.
I was listening to you when you first mentioned the unusual events that happened at the police department when Zimmerman arrived, and how it was suspicious how he was able to just walk out after it appeared he was arrested. Do you have any ideas of what would have made it so easy for him to be to walk out like that? Now, I did hear his father was a judge, and maybe he had
a magistrate. A magistrate.
Okay. Or somebody that knows the machinery of that particular police department and how it operates under those conditions. Do you have
but
any...
But actually, Zimmerman himself, being very interested in becoming a police officer, had, you know, he had driven around with the police. You know, from time to time they do that. They take a civilian around just to get a sense of what it is they do. So he was apparently not an unknown to some of the officers there. But my point is that somebody has to explain it. Somebody is accountable for unarresting a person in a homicide. You know, when they bring you in handcuffs, you are in the custody of the state. So somebody had to have made a decision. And it's not a whole bunch of people. It's a very tight circle. It's not a whole, you don't have to go interview thousands of people. They are known, I'm sure they are known, whoever made that decision, and they should be made to explain that. The prosecutor's office has had to have been involved, just absolutely had to be involved. A police officer, senior level, administrative type, at the station house had to have been involved, and possibly a judge, because usually the procedure is you're brought in and then you're processed. This man was not processed. Somebody decided, hey, we could, you know, just let him go. You know, he's had a rough day. Let him go and rest up a little bit, and whenever he's ready, we'll pick up the conversation, you know, the next time, but not tonight.
Excuse
we don't have to talk
me,
to him tonight.
Do you believe that if the federal agencies step into this case, that they will, that it's their responsibility to get into that and find out from step one who was responsible for those chain of events?
Oh, yes, but, you know, this is the thing. These matters... And I've talked about it in terms of New York City as well, where, you know, we have a major event occurring, just like the Diallo case. Four police officers shoot a civilian, just a guy just trying to get home so he can sleep and rest. These matters really shouldn't be a federal matter, because the local people have absolute control over this. New York City has always had control over the police department, the city council. It just refused to exercise that power. So if it is that the U.S. Department of Justice has to do it, they will be very, very reluctant to do it. Why? Because the local system is Republican-controlled, and, of course, we have a Democratic administration. It's politics. They don't want to come in and, you know, get heavy-handed with a Republican administration locally. They don't want to actually deal with police corruption. They don't want to deal with it. So they will talk about the civil rights violations rather than let us find out who made these things, these decisions, put names to faces, and get them out. Sorry. I overspoke.
So how does the Martin family get justice then if they can't depend on the federal government to step in and, you know, I mean, I was under the impression they supersede any state laws or to be able to get to the bottom of these kind of tragedies. That
in this sense, they could only... They could be involved only on the civil level, because the criminal matter is state controlled. That's under the state. The state adjudicates on these matters. So the federal government, unless there is an extraordinary lapse and a real huge problem, would they step in? But even so, the case would then go through its, you know, they put it through its motions. until it reaches the appellate level, and then perhaps the federal government will get involved. For now, they're asking for civil violations to be levied against Zimmerman, and I mean, frankly, it's a thing for more symbolic reasons, I think, than for anything else. The real use for the federal government here is to just go in there with a bulldozer and tear the place apart. Find out who made these decisions. Why? And what were the consequences of these decisions? That's what the federal government could be useful for, because in effect they will be investigating corruption, and this is, in my view, the end result of corruption. And it's not just the police; it involves the prosecutor's office. It had to have involved the prosecutor's office and police. Those absolutely were involved. And possibly even a judge. So I think that's where the concentration ought to be. And of course, you know, the federal government has they will be involved in the civil action merely for, you know, to make a moral point. But I don't know that you would get anything from a federal intervention here on civil grounds. The family has its own civil action that it's going to bring. But the federal government's real assistance here would be to bust up this corruption. Wow. Thank you, Lloyd, for calling. Thanks so much. Adrian from New Jersey, you're on. Thank you.
Oh, good afternoon. I'd like to point out that there's a possibility, instead of it being corruption, as you've just been talking about, it is complete and utter ineptitude, which has driven this this case. In fact, Ian Masterson on background briefing on PFK in California interviewed Jeffrey Weiner, who is the head of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. He's also a defense lawyer in Florida. And in that interview, he points out many of the mistakes that were made by the law in Florida. And I think you'll find, when you listen to it very carefully, that the majority of it was just complete inept lawyering. So I think you might be overstating when you're saying that there's some agenda here other than...
Oh, there is. There is no question in my mind that there is. And this is not just being inept. When you have a case assigned to a special prosecutor, you do not accept ineptitude. It is not something that is part of the equation.
What you're dealing with. You're just dealing with ineptitude.
No. This is not ineptitude. Because the case, in the first instance, was railroaded. This case did not come before a grand jury. Why? And that was the special prosecutor's sole decision. She decided within 2 days of being assigned as special prosecutor in this case, I don't need the grand jury here. We're going to go for second degree because that's the limit of my authority, and that's where I'm going. The case was the byproduct of a number of things. Number one, don't forget, the prosecutor clearly knows that something went wrong in that station house. They're not interested in anybody going back to the night of the event at the station house, which involves the prosecutor's office.
Right, and you can't see, or you think that there was just not ineptitude? Because
the majority
of our government is driven by ineptitude.
Oh, no. We see ineptitude all over the place. I'm saying that this is compounded. Ineptitude, I accept. Because the attitude is that the lives of African Americans, Latinos, these people are dispensable. These are expendable. They're not really very important. And if you study the history of this particular special prosecutor, you would see, of course, what her mentality is. She was quite good at getting a conviction of a woman who, in an attempt to defend herself from an abusive husband, fired a shot from her gun into the wall, and she's doing 20 years. So she was quite efficient and quite effective there. So they can't pick and choose ineptitude. This is something that was, they had some reason to basically shove aside what they know was committed at the station house on the night of the event. They do it. They did it. And of course, yes, ineptitude, but you see that every day. Don't forget,
right,
the prosecutor's office.
A microcosm of that.
The prosecutor's office is where it's just like the many of the they call them inner city hospitals. This is where people cut their teeth before they go into private practice. So they don't have a particular zeal for really excelling at the law. This was not clearly. I mean, when you have your lead, one of your lead witnesses, the medical examiner, come on the stand and announce, I'm not here, I don't know anything about this case, because I didn't remember a thing, don't have anything to say about this case, don't ask me, because I don't know. Maybe that is lawyering 101, wouldn't you say? Is that ineptitude,
right,
or is that pure stupidity?
No, absolute stupidity. No question about that. I mean, and that is pervasive throughout the whole case. But yet, anyway, just to point out, I want to get off the phone so you can talk to other people, but I would very much like you, if you get a chance to listen to this interview, I think you'll find it enlightening. Maybe
thank you. I found Mark Garagos extremely enlightening, and I wish, you know, we had the opportunity to interview him soon. Thank you so much for calling, Adrian.
Thank you.
Hello, Greet from Baltimore.
Hello, you trees. First, I just want to say that, you know, I really appreciate you, and I admire you and what you do.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You trees, you hit on it over the past few days, and the last time I called you, I said that our number one job is to get rid of white supremacy. And I don't think that most people, and there's no excuse for black people not understanding what white supremacy and racism are. If we understand those concepts, then everything that happens in this country becomes clear. We're all white supremacists. I'm talking about black people, everybody. White supremacy is simply the idea that white is supreme and every other group, depending on its complexion and how close it is to white, ranks below white until you get to us. We're the darkest people on the planet. All over the world, we have to be on the bottom. God did not create us to be on the bottom. Our history demonstrates that we are not the worst or the least of people on the earth. We are on the bottom because it's been so decreed by white people. And racism is the belief and the enactment of that idea. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm listening.
Oh, beautiful. Well,
I listen very intently, you know.
Even when we kill each other, it's based on white racism. It's based on white supremacy, I should say. We have little regard for black life, too, because we've been immersed in white supremacy from the womb. So there are other things I want to say, but it's just like the Snowden incident. I'm not concerned about Snowden and his relationship to the United States, because anything that challenges white supremacy, and Snowden by his actions have caused people around the world to make a decision. I mean, specifically darker people in Latin America who have said that they would give him asylum. But we have no friends because this is a worldwide system. And, you know, like I said, there's no excuse for us not understanding this because, you know, Dr. Welsing, you know, has put it forth so eloquently and so clearly, but we aren't doing, you know, we're not reading, we're not, you know, the Bible says, Hosea it says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And it talks about how we reject knowledge. And that's exactly what we're doing because these things happen over and over again. They've happened throughout all of our lives. They've happened throughout all the history in this country that we can read about. And we get upset about one incident and what we're going to do about one incident, and we never address, okay, well, I'm going to be specific now, but what we should...
Well, you also have to be quick because we're close to running out of time, I'm afraid.
Okay. But we, like you said, you resent having to educate other people. We need to leave other people alone and work on ourselves and get our minds clear of white supremacy, which will never happen in our lives, but we have to produce a generation eventually that isn't, you know, that doesn't, isn't forced to believe in white supremacy.
Well, thank you for contributing that.
Thank
you so much. I think we have work on all sides to do. This is one of the things that I've pointed out with the progressive and the left of center communities. They're not doing the requisite work in their communities. And African Americans need to do more in our communities as well. But we have to dismantle this thing. It is pernicious, and it is continuing to wreak havoc in our lives. It really is, and we've got to. I want to see movement in the white community. That you're doing the work, and I see that happening mostly among the younger group. But you know, fuddy-duddies like me in my age, we're not doing the work that we need to do. Well, we've come to the end of our program today, and I'm thankful that we had this time to share these thoughts. Harvey, John, Jay, Sean, Eric, Lloyd, Adrian, and Greed from Baltimore, thank you so much for calling in and making meaningful contributions to this program today. We'll come back again to each other tomorrow, same time, and let's continue the conversation because it is necessary. Thank you so much for being with me today. And thanks for your concerns, but my jaw is coming back.